From WXXI News, I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections. Our guest this hour is Tom Golisano. He's joining us from Florida, talking about his brand new book called Built, Not Born, a self-made billionaire's no-nonsense guide for entrepreneurs. The book focuses on his business philosophy that started, of course, in 1971 with the launch of Paychex, and it has grown, I would have to think, much beyond what he thought even possible. He had big dreams, but really modest ideas at the time. But Tom Golisano turned Paychex into the juggernaut it became because he challenged orthodoxy in his industry. He broke some barriers, and Paychex is, of course, a massive success story. So how did he do it? What does he advise entrepreneurs? We're going to talk to Tom Golisano about that and more coming up on Connections.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A federal judge is expected to sentence longtime Trump advisor Roger Stone any moment now. NPR's Bobby Allen reports Stone was the sixth Trump associate convicted in connection with former special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russia's election interference in 2016 and links to the Trump campaign.
The case against Stone focused on his efforts to obtain Russian-hacked emails that could be damaging to Hillary Clinton in the lead-up to the 2016 election. Prosecutors said Stone served as an access point between the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks. Stone was also in touch with an online persona known as Guccifer 2.0, believed to be a front for Russian intelligence officials. A jury in November found Stone guilty of lying to investigators, obstructing a congressional probe, and witness tampering. Bobby Allen, NPR News, Washington.
Federal prosecutors had recommended 7 to 9 years for Roger Stone. The Department of Justice then backed down after President Trump protested that recommendation. The Chancellor of Germany is imploring her fellow countrymen and women to overcome the poison of racism hours after suspected far-right extremists ambushed two hookah bars in the Frankfurt area. The majority of the 9 people he killed were Turks. The suspected gunman was later found dead at his home along with his mother. Investigators are treating the case as an act of domestic terrorism. They say the 43-year-old shooter posted a manifesto calling for the extermination of multiple races and cultures. There has been an attack in London. Police say a man in his 70s was stabbed at a mosque where witnesses say the victim leads a call to prayer. Another man has been arrested. As the Nevada State Democratic Party gears up for its caucuses Saturday, Democrats in the state's many rural counties are facing significant hurdles in a caucus system. Bree Zender of member station KUNR in Reno has the latest.
Though Nevada has a fair amount of cities, the vast amount of the state is a sea of sagebrush with very few towns. And that makes it tough for some counties to caucus. Pershing and White Pine counties in the northern part of the state only have one caucus site available in one day for early voting. Kimmy Cole, chair of the Rural Nevada Democratic Caucus, says some have to travel up to 100 miles to join in.
I do know some people that, have challenges with transportation, maybe not the best eyesight. And then some people just say, hey, that's too far to go to participate.
Cole says there's more volunteers helping out this year, and rural counties will be able to pull off a smooth caucus. For NPR News, I'm Bree Zender in Reno.
U.S. stocks are trading lower, with the Dow down roughly 1% since the open at 29,057. The Nasdaq has also fallen 1.3%. It's at 96.82. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is WXXI News. Good afternoon. I'm Beth Adams. For the second time in a month, a Monroe County Elections Commissioner has resigned. Republican Commissioner Doug French was the first to give up his position. And yesterday, Democratic Commissioner Colleen Anderson announced she is stepping down. In an email to party leaders, she said the demands of the job did not allow her enough work-life balance. Anderson said she is moving on to another position, County Purchasing Manager. As state law requires, the Deputy Elections Commissioners for each political party will become acting commissioners until their permanent successors are elected within 45 days. The departures of Anderson and French come as the county gets ready for two primary elections and one general election that are expected to generate high voter turnout this year. A Rochester drug distributor accused of fueling the opioid epidemic is telling the state labor department that it plans to shut down its local operations. WXXI's Brett Dahlberg reports.
The Rochester Drug Cooperative paid millions in fines after admitting that it knowingly violated federal narcotics laws. Then the company shut down its narcotics business. Now the company has filed official notice that it could lay off all of its local workers. Spokesman Jeff Eller says the drug company has been under significant financial stress. Layoff notices started going out last week. The paperwork that the drug cooperative filed with the state labor department says it plans to fire everyone by the end of May. But Eller says the truth might not be so definite. He says the filings look black and white, but that's because of legal requirements to plan for economic disruptions. He says the company could still find a way to keep its distribution center in Rochester open. Brett Dahlberg, WXXI News.
Our weather today, quite cold with flurries and localized areas of lake snow. Wind chills into the teens with a high temperature of 21. Tonight, flurries and limited lake snow later at night in northern Monroe and Wayne counties, producing minor accumulations. Find more news at WXXINews.org.
From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1971 when an almost 30-year-old man from Rochester launched a small business. It was a payroll processing company, and his goals were rather modest. He wanted to make enough money to support his family and ensure that his developmentally disabled son would never have to live in a state-run facility. He started with about $3,000 in the hope that this company could at least become sustainable. His name was Tom Golisano, and he built his company by challenging commonly held beliefs. One of them was that only large companies needed outside payroll services. Well, 95% of American businesses at the time had 50 employees or fewer, and either Tom Golisano's hunch was going to pay off, or his company would probably collapse. You know how it's turned out. In a new book, Golisano reminds readers that he didn't take a paycheck for several years. It wasn't easy in the beginning, and he believes that his accumulated wisdom can help others. His book is called Built, Not Born, A Self-Made Billionaire's Guide for Entrepreneurs. And he is back with us on Connections today, joining us from Vox Now Studios in Naples, Florida, where it's always nice to talk to you. How are you, Tom?
I'm doing great, Evan. How are you? It's been a while since I've talked to you. How are you doing?
I'm very well, sir. And I'm wondering, I mean, it's a sort of a trite thing to say, but you might as well tell us we're in the low 20s here today. What's the weather like down there?
Okay, well, it's noontime here, and it's about 80 degrees, pure sunshine. It's a normal Naples winter day.
You didn't just go there to avoid paying taxes, see?
No, not quite. Quite frankly, when I was younger, I always wanted to move out of cold weather, either to Florida or California. And my significant other at the time wasn't willing to do that, so I stayed in Rochester all those years, hoping someday I could move to a warmer place. And now I've had the opportunity, and I'm really enjoying it.
Well,
all the other advantages.
Well, you're writing books, and I know you got an autobiography coming out. I'll let our listeners know this book is really an entrepreneur's guide. It's a business book. It's not an autobiography. That one is still in the works. Is that correct?
Actually, it's all done, and we're talking to publishers at this time.
All right. So we're going to talk about that in a second. I'm also wondering, you know, you've watched, you know, your colleagues, Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz gave it a shot. Tom Steyer still running. Donald Trump is the president. Michael Bloomberg's rising in recent polls. Is this the time for you to dip your toe back in? Are you going to run for president? I mean, all the other billionaires are in there.
I'm afraid not, Evan. I'm afraid not. I think at my age, I've reached a point where it's not a practical idea.
You're Bernie Sanders'
age. So I'm
going
to stay right where I am.
You're young for politics. You're Bernie Sanders' age.
Yeah, I know. As I was watching the debates last night, I was thinking about that. I said, gee, what would it be like to be president when you're 82 years old? And I tell you, I think it's a challenge.
You honestly think age is a factor that ought to be considered right now?
Yes, I do.
Is there
I feel pretty firmly about that.
Yeah, I mean, Jimmy Carter recently weighed in and basically said he had some similar sentiments. He's a little concerned just about sharpness and really endurance, the daily demands. What do you think? I mean, is it sort of an arbitrary number of a cutoff? Is it person to person? How do you view age in the presidency?
Well, I know we're all different, but I sort of go by myself at least a small bit saying, gee, a little droppage in sharpness or, as you said, endurance could be a real issue in a job of that importance and that level. So I'd just be concerned about it. Maybe Trump would be fine. Maybe Sanders would be fine. But I just say the likelihood of it being sustainable over a long period of time, particularly two terms, I don't think it's really a good practical idea.
Are you surprised to see billionaires like Mike Bloomberg, Tom Steyer? I mean, Steyer's hanging around, but Bloomberg has a real shot based on polling. Does that surprise you at all?
No, I'm not surprised that billionaires or millionaires are involved in politics. I think basically they are entrepreneurs. And the trait of entrepreneurs is they want to fix things. They look for opportunities to change things for the better. And if they get frustrated with their government, either at the state or federal level, they get inspired to want to do something about it. So it's very understanding to me. It's probably the exact same reason I ran for governor three times back in the 90s.
The dynamic that's sort of interesting now, watching first Howard Schultz, Tom Steyer, now Michael Bloomberg, is there seems to be more scrutiny based on just the idea of billionaires in general. Ezra Klein, journalist, a left-leaning journalist recently, wrote, quote, "I worked very hard for it is the worst possible justification for being a billionaire. You know who works very hard? Single mothers working two minimum wage jobs with just-in-time scheduling and a bus commute. That's who," end quote. I mean, is that a fair characterization, Tom, that, you know, people like Ezra feel like just saying I worked very hard for it, it shouldn't be enough to say some people become billionaires and others struggle?
Well, the reality of the situation is that a lot of it depends on your environment, your situation. I never planned to become, as you call it, a billionaire or even a multimillionaire. But I found myself in a set of circumstances where the opportunity was there. And I felt compelled to stay with that opportunity and continue to develop it as much as I could. Now, right now, obviously, we have thousands and thousands of shareholders that have paid for college educations, they've paid for retirements, they've paid for probably grand vacations and all that. That's a byproduct of what we did. Now, where I ended up, I didn't plan on it. I'm glad I'm there. It certainly has helped me in the area of philanthropy. And I think most billionaires or millionaires feel really positive about philanthropy. Mike Bloomberg and Donald Trump are certainly examples of it.
Well, so I want to kind of dive into the book here, but you bring up philanthropy, so let's kind of, because you only mention it in the book a little bit. You mention at the end that you're going to talk a lot more about your own philanthropic contributions. And to be fair and to be transparent, we have appreciated you and the contributions and the relationships with the Golisano Foundation and with you for many, many years in WXXI. And you know, I mean, I know we don't take it for granted, but I also know, you know, that you come on this program and it's good to talk about these things. So let me ask you, generally speaking, younger Americans are suspicious of capitalism in pretty large numbers now, much more so than when you know, you were in your 20s or I was in my 20s. I certainly understand that you would probably be disappointed to see suspicion of capitalism rising in young adults. But I want to ask if you have an idea about why they have such suspicion of capitalism.
Well, I can only base this on intuition, but I have the feeling that the guilt lies with our educational system. In talking to my children and my grandchildren about their educations at the secondary school level, it's not like capitalism is extolled as a great virtue, a great economy, a great way to build wealth in a country. It's like it's demeaning. And when you have situations like three candidates or two candidates up there on the stage demeaning people that have achieved great success, you can understand why they're concerned about it. Also, I think socialism as an idea, as a concept, comes around to a civilization or to an economy on a regular basis. But as soon as people realize it's not the way to go, it's not the way to build a good quality of life, they turn away from it. I think we're just going through one of those stages now.
Do you think it's possible that in the current system, people are legitimately hurting and they're not feeling the kinds of effects or rewards that you would hope capitalism would have?
Well, let's face the reality, Evan. No matter how great your economy is, no matter how much wealth has been created in your country, you have to understand there's always a bell curve of wealth or success. But you know what I mean by bell curve? 10%
oh, sure.
at the high end, 10% at the low end. So no matter how good your economy is, you always have a bell curve, and there's always going to be people at the low end of it. Now, I think the great thing about the United States, considering that bell curve, the people at the lower end probably have a better lifestyle and living conditions than they do any place else in the world. I'm not sure of that, but I'm guessing that. So no matter how successful we are as the economy, you're always going to have a low end of the socioeconomic curve.
I think that's what probably animates the Sanders campaign, is that a belief that the people on one end of that curve, the hurting end of that curve, are not experiencing a good life, even when they feel like they're working hard. I think that's what Ezra Klein was saying. And it sounds like you either dispute that they're struggling or that you think that that's sort of a natural product of a capitalistic society.
I think it's a natural product of a capitalistic society, which I think in the end, we've all seen concepts or understood concepts where everybody is treated exactly the same no matter how hard they work. Generally, your level of productivity goes down and goes down substantially, just like the old classroom, you know, where the teacher marks on the curve, mm-hmm. and everybody passed, but everybody did the same level of work, and nobody excelled. Sooner or later, your quality or productivity is going to go down in that environment.
Yeah, and I think people look at someone like Jeff Bezos, who has amassed many, many billions of dollars, and they look at employees in the warehouse who are, I mean, literally wearing diapers because they don't feel like they have enough time to go to the bathroom, and thinking, why has one guy got billions of dollars when the people he's employing don't have enough time to make a restroom break, and thinking that is a broken kind of society, capitalism or not. Do you disagree?
Well, first of all, I'd be very surprised if that environment exists in an American company. If it did, I'd say shame on them, but I doubt very much if it exists. But the fact of the matter is, in a capitalistic society, everybody has opportunity. Now, you might say, well, not everybody has equal opportunity, but everybody does have opportunity to a certain degree. It's pretty level situation.
Do you think?
You know, when I started Paychex, I had no idea where it was going to end up. But I kept working on it. I tried to keep making it grow and be more productive and be more profitable. And I look back and I say, well, gee, I created 15,500 jobs across the country. The people are pretty economically secure. We provide a very valuable service to 670,000 companies. Why should I feel guilty about becoming a billionaire? I worked hard. I created a lot of value. And you, as you mentioned, the philanthropy is significant that I've been able to give to organizations that are deserving of it. And the security that I've created for so many people and so many shareholders.
Yeah, I think most Americans would agree, generally speaking, that if you work hard, you ought to be successful. And I would share your concern.
Well, that's not true, Evan. I'm gonna stop you right there. Working hard is not the only criteria. Did you ever hear the expression, you keep your shoulder to the wheel? The only thing you're sure of is getting a sore shoulder. You got to work hard, but you also got to be intelligent and smart about what you're doing.
Okay, and that's...
You understand what I'm saying?
Well, I read your book, absolutely, and we're going to talk about those tenets coming up here in just a second, because, by the way, for listeners, I mean, Tom's got a lot to say about what it means to work smart, not just work hard. I think, so I take that point, Tom. I think, just generally speaking, though, people would look at Michael Bloomberg and say, you were innovative, you filled a need, you identified a problem and you solved it, and you made money, and you worked hard and you worked smart and you made money. But making $60 billion is not the same as working hard and working smart to most people, I think, and being well off. $60 billion is excessively well off to a lot of Americans who can work hard, maybe not be as innovative, but at the same time work hard every day and have one injury and they go to the ER and they feel like they're bankrupt. I mean, that's where I think people are maybe beyond just the educational system feeling like, is this system working? If one guy's got $60 billion, and I'm working hard every day, and I fell and broke my ankle, and now I may be bankrupt, then I'm not sure this is working. Does that make sense?
Don't you think it's a good idea to have people like Michael Bloomberg, who have done so well successfully, who creates an incentive, who creates a vision for people to be able to accomplish what he accomplished. I think it's terrific that we have Michael Bloomberg's and Jeff Bezos. Those people have created fantastic organizations. They employ hundreds of thousands of people. Where would those people be working if Michael Bloomberg didn't do what he did, or Jeff Bezos didn't do what he did? They might be working, but they're probably working for a lot less dollars. So I credit those people with performing well and doing a great service to our economy.
Well, Bloomberg has given millions of dollars to cities for various reasons. He's got a philanthropic organization, Bloomberg Philanthropies, which you're probably familiar with, and he's now piling up endorsements from mayors of those cities, including Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren. Do you think there's anything crass or problematic about a connection between Bloomberg money and the endorsements? Or I should ask, do you think there's a connection between the Bloomberg philanthropy money and those endorsements?
I can't comment on it because I'm not sure I know or have any information about it.
Okay. And when it comes to philanthropy, I mean, this is what I think I mean by saying in the last year, there's been a different kind of conversation. I mean, I watched last spring when Robert Smith, who's a billionaire tech investor, gave a speech to graduating students at Morehouse College, 400 graduating students. And right there in the middle of the speech, he announced he was personally going to wipe out the loan debt for all of the graduating class of 2019 at Morehouse. 400 students, total debt load of about $20 million. He wiped it out in one shot. And Smith was cheered by the media and by political leaders. But then we saw sort of this, a little bit of a backlash. Writers like the journalist Anand Giridharadas, who writes that, essentially summarizing what Giridharadas is writing, he says, Robert Smith's gift was kind, but it's also revealing about our culture that he's more interested in getting a headline, making one gift, instead of paying a regular tax load, and therefore you could fund a lot more of these students. Giridharadas says, Smith spends a lot of his time trying to create tax loopholes so he has to pay a lower tax burden. Then he gets headlines with one gift instead of just paying your tax load, then you can fund a lot more students than just these Morehouse students. And maybe you don't get the philanthropic headlines, but it's more equitable that way. And I suspect you disagree.
No good deed goes unpunished in this world. And that sounds like an excellent example of it. Here the guy is trying to do something for a group of people to help them out. And some writer comes along and tries to punish him for it. I don't buy it.
Yeah, I think the writer would say he could help many more than just those 400 if he stopped fighting paying a regular tax load.
How is he fighting paying a regular tax load?
He has,
I would assume he's following the IRS guidelines.
He is, but he's tried to leverage sort of his position of relative power to kind of make sure that loopholes are protected, tax loopholes, that there's a lot of advantages that he could probably have.
You know, Congress makes the laws.
Yeah.
And if you heard Mike Bloomberg last night, and I'm not a big proponent of Mike Bloomberg, but I don't know if you caught what he said to Saunders when he was accused of not paying his fair share of taxes. Congress makes the laws. They make the rules. So why would you blame the taxpayer for not paying what somebody perceives as being their fair share?
Well, let's talk about Tom's book.
I was just going to suggest that, Evan.
Tom's book has a lot that has advice for business, for entrepreneurs on a lot of different levels. And if you're thinking about starting a business, if you've thought about, I've got an idea that might work, but I don't know if I have the capital or I don't know if I can set it up this way, that's what Built Not Born is about. So let's start with one thing that I think was a bit of a surprise. The first thing people should do when they start a business, you say, people might laugh, but you're serious, get a prenup. What do you mean by get a prenup?
Well, it's called a prenuptial agreement, and it's usually a contract between two people before they get married. And the reason for the verbiage in the book is quite important and quite clear. If you have a situation where there's a business that was started by one of the partners in the marriage, and there is no prenup contract, and it comes a time when the two people decide they want to go their separate ways, and there's usually a settlement or a cash settlement that has to be involved. Well, the settlement would probably be so high that the other person may not be able to afford it because of lack of liquidity. So what happens or could happen is they're forced to sell the business. And if you're forced to sell the business at somebody else's timing and not your timing, you're probably not going to get as much for it if it's a forced sale. So consequently, it creates a situation where an entrepreneur has created a really good business, but because of this settlement situation, they have to sell the business at a time when they don't want to because of future potential growth or just because they want to keep working at it.
Yeah.
So I think a prenup contract or a postnup contract is really a good idea, and it's designed to protect both people. Of course, one of the things you can do in a situation like that is fund it with life insurance. In other words, if there's going to be a future settlement, one of the ways you can fund it is through life insurance with a buy-sell agreement.
I think you outline some of the, I don't know if overconfidence, but some of the mistakes entrepreneurs might make when they're really starting out. They have an idea they really like, they think they can sell it, and they think that nothing is ever going to break down. So the prenup is one idea that you have, but you also warn entrepreneurs, be careful not to overestimate your ability to sell your product or service. And you make a point that I think is interesting. You write that sales and marketing are not the same, that academic programs especially focus on the marketing side but fail to discuss the actual act of selling. Tell us about that.
Well, I think you hit on the number one issue as it pertains to entrepreneurs and their ability to be successful. You know, an entrepreneur starts their venture, the first thing they're going to do is speculate on how much revenue they're going to bring in, how much sales activity there's going to be. And generally speaking, when they hang up their shingle or put up their sign, whatever, they just have the feeling that the world is going to be coming to them. Well, it doesn't work that way for sure. They're going to have to go out and dig and dig and dig to bring in customers or clients, whatever. So what happens in many entrepreneurial situations, the entrepreneur has a set of projections and he bases his cash flow situation on those projections. Well, if he doesn't meet those sales projections, he's going to end up with a cash flow problem. And generally, when you hear about an entrepreneur saying, gee, I have a cash flow problem, generally speaking, he really has a sales problem. As to the difference between sales and marketing, sales to me, it's always been the driving force at Paychex. Today, I think we have over 2,500 salespeople out in the field selling our products. Sales management is very, very important. Entrepreneur, first of all, before he has any salespeople working for him, he should be able to go out and sell the product himself because he's going to be the one that's going to be best situated to train his salespeople. And if he hasn't been out in the field and he hasn't been selling his product, I don't know who's going to train his salespeople. So consequently, sales and marketing are a very key part of any entrepreneurial experience. And if there's any place where entrepreneurs fall down, it's in this area.
Well, and you're someone who built the company and had to do that yourself before it grew into the size of a company it is today. So for years, people could look to you and say, well, he's done it. He knows what he's talking about. But there are, it seems to me at least, I mean, you talk to people in a lot of different lines of work, companies that are sort of stagnating. There's a lot of corner offices where whoever's in that corner office hasn't actually done the selling. Why is that?
Well, it's a good question. Maybe it depends on where that person in the corner office came into the organization. If he was there at the beginning, I'd be very surprised if he didn't get involved in the sales process. But, you know, somebody that comes into an organization sort of in the middle or somewhere down its path, like Marty Musi, who's a great CEO of Paychex, has never, I think, been directly in a sales position. But certainly he understands enough about it to get the job done.
Yeah, I'm sure it's possible to sort of identify maybe where a weak spot is and learn, and I think that's really valuable. But I think it is probably a surprise to those who are in academic programs to hear your take on the fact that academic programs focus so much on marketing but fail to discuss the actual act of selling. Why do you think academic programs, to the extent that they might fall short in this area, why is that happening?
I wish I knew the exact answer to that question. I'm starting to see a little bit of recognition of this issue in some colleges and universities where they are starting to teach sales and sales management. But mainly the emphasis today and recent history has always been on marketing. I don't know if there's something glorious about marketing versus sales. Maybe it's, you know, it creates a better dream, if you will. But I think some of the colleges and universities are starting to come around, but it's really been slow.
Well, you also write about when you're starting out, having sufficient capital. And you write, if you don't have sufficient capital to start your business, then don't. But for those who are in the position of wanting to get out on their own, how do you know how much capital is sufficient, Tom?
I don't think you ever really know for sure. All you can do is speculate, or if you want, call it guesswork. But it's probably a good idea, if at all, to have some sort of situation, maybe with a relative or a banking relationship, whereas if you need more capital at a later date, you're able to attain it. I was in a position at one point in Paychex in the mid-70s where I was in need of capital, and I was fortunate enough to have my sister, who had enough funds in her savings account to be able to help me to the point I needed it. It was a lifesaver, believe me. But if you can't have a situation like that, you've just got to be able to maybe have potential investors to invest in your company. So having a little insurance on the capital side is always a good idea. Most often, though, entrepreneurs really underestimate how much cash they're going to need, and it's because of the sales problem.
You also, as I mentioned at the outset, you remind your readers that you didn't take a paycheck yourself for several years. And I'm thinking of a friend who launched a company in the Midwest and had a couple of hard first couple of years, then had a couple of outstanding years, and then had to start hiring staff. And he kind of joked after about 6 or 7 years, he said, boy, once I had to start hiring staff, we were growing. And there was more revenue coming in, but I think I was like making less money. That there are going to be little humps to get over here. How important is it that whoever is starting out understands that those first few years can be lean, and maybe knows that, you know, I mean, if you don't have reserves for yourself personally, that it's going to be a hard go.
Any entrepreneur that doesn't realize those potential circumstances is making a big mistake. That's about all I can say about it. You've got to have enough capital to make sure you're over the hump. Like you said about myself, I went 4 years without getting a paycheck. Fortunately, I had a spouse at the time that worked and brought in some income, and we were able to survive. But I can tell you there are many times I came home and I looked in the refrigerator and there was nothing in there.
Was there a moment for you in those early years where you said, you know, this is it. This is going to work. This could really grow. This could be big.
I think that moment came about 4 or 5 years into it. Mm-hmm. And what happened was I had a friend of mine who worked at another company at the same time I did come into my office and looked me in the eye and said, Tom, he says, it looks like this paychex idea is working. Could I possibly move to another city and start a similar operation? And his name was Phil. And I said, Phil, yes, why not? How about we could go to Buffalo and Syracuse and potentially Albany? And we got him set up, and we went in partners together. And then a short time later, an employee of a client walked in the door, picked up his payroll, saw me, and said, Tom, this is a great idea. Could I go someplace and start one like you have here in Rochester? And I said, yeah. His name was Chuck. I said, Chuck, where are you interested in going? He says, well, I'd like to go to Miami. So I thought that was a good idea. So I said, Chuck, yeah, I'll be your partner. Well, he looked at me, and he says, no, I don't want to be your partner, but I'll be your franchisee. And I said, okay. We discussed a franchise agreement, signed it, and off he went. After I got these two people established, I said, gee, maybe this is a way to build a national organization. So I then began recruiting people to be my partners or my franchisees and ended up with 17 of them. All but one of them lived in Rochester, New York, and moved to other parts of the country. The one that didn't come from Rochester, came from Detroit, Michigan. So all of a sudden, during a 4 or 5 year period, we woke up one morning and realized, hey, we have a nationwide organization, and we were able to pull it off in a fairly short period of time. The next big move was to consolidate these 18 different companies into one. And I made a proposal to all the people involved that we should become employees and shareholders of a new, larger company, which was kind of against what I had sold them on, the idea of being an entrepreneur first. And here I was just a short time later, a year or two, telling them they should become part of a larger organization and become employees and shareholders. Well, all of them agreed to do it, and we had a big paper signing party in Chicago, and 18 corporations became one. And that's when Paychex really began to grow.
Well, and you know, you knew early on that you would be willing to buy what you're attempting to sell. That's chapter four in your book. Would you be willing to buy what you're attempting to sell? And, you know, at first you go, well, why would anybody start a company if they're not willing to buy what they're attempting to sell? But then you think about all the sort of the failed ideas out there, and you think, how well did you really think through this? And I suspect there's a lot of people who are trying to sell products or services that they themselves don't find all of that compelling.
Now, that's probably true. And the other thing that goes along with that mentality, Evan, is can you sell the product or service at a price that can make you money? Mm. So it's not a matter of just whether it's a good product or not, but can you create the product, sell it to a potential customer, and still make enough money to make your effort worthwhile? That's the second criteria that's most important.
And speaking of making money, after our only break of the hour, I want to talk to Tom about something that he calls elephants in his book, the big client. And if you're starting a company, if you're starting out thinking all we need is one big one, is that a good idea? Tom discusses that in his book, Built Not Born. We're also going to talk about recurring revenue. And I think a good example of that for Tom Golisano was even outside of Paychex when he purchased the Buffalo Sabres and had to look at how many season ticket holders they had, and what were they going to do about that. Those stories and more with Tom Golisano. He's joining us from Naples, Florida today, and he's got a new book out called Built Not Born, A Self-Made Billionaire's No-Nonsense Guide for Entrepreneurs. That's next. Coming up in our second hour, an exhibit set to open Friday at the Visual Studies Workshop in Rochester explores perceptions of black masculinity and gender identity. The artist is Joshua Rashad McFadden. We're talking about evidence and the themes explored in this exhibit, black masculinity and more, next hour on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tom Golisano on the line with us from Naples, Florida, and he's got a new book out called Built Not Born, and I want to know if elephants is your term. Did you coin that?
I don't think so, Evan. I think I've heard it before, but
I like it.
It certainly fits the description about what I'm talking about. And what that is some people, when they start their enterprises or they're well into their enterprise, they go after the big customer, the customer or the potential client that's going to bring a lot of revenue in a very short period of time. Well, you have to remember those clients or customers are probably much more difficult to sell. It's a longer sales cycle. They're probably going to be much more concerned about pricing, et cetera. And what you're doing is also creating a situation where the livelihood of your business may depend on one or two big customers. That's not a good environment to be in. And sort of the basis for Paychex, going after the small business market, 1 to 100 employees, we never had a customer that was more than 1/1000th of our revenue, so that if we lost that customer for whatever reason, and it could be very good reasons, our service could have been great, but for one reason or another, they left our service, it wouldn't hurt us that bad. And that's where this recurring revenue theme comes into play, too. I like the idea of having revenue come in constantly. In other words, you sell a client once or a customer once, and they continue to use a service that you provide. That's obviously the story of Paychex. If you're selling something like automobiles or furniture or whatever, you're constantly worried about where the next sale is coming from. Now, it may be harder to build revenue that's recurring, but in the long run, it's much more secure and much safer.
You had me thinking as I read that section, and I agreed with you, by the way, that most people would be surprised to find out that Paychex doesn't have and hasn't had any single customer accounting for more than 0.1% of revenue. And I'm wondering, how many of the biggest, most successful companies in this country are in that category, where there isn't an elephant, there isn't any customer that's a tenth of a percent, let alone even 1%, Tom? Any guess at that?
I've never tried to think about that and speculate on how many there might be, but I bet you there's quite a few.
Yeah, and so do you advise entrepreneurs, generally speaking, to avoid going after elephants entirely?
No, I think it should be a secondary sales effort, though. Mm-hmm, Go after the people that you're more likely to make a fairly quicker sale and be more much from a profit perspective might be higher on a per unit basis. By the way, that's the basis of paychecks. And let me explain that for a second. If you sign up one 100-person payroll versus 10 10-person payrolls, because of the way payroll processors price, the more units, the lower the cost per unit. In other words, the higher the number of checks, the lower revenue you're going to get per check. Well, with that mentality, selling 10 10-person companies is 2.5 times the revenue of one 100-person company. 10 tens, 2.5 times the revenue of one 100-person. Well, you might say, well, you got to do 10 payroll companies, 10 payroll clients versus one. But it doesn't transfer to 2.5 times the revenue, far from it. So it's a much more profitable situation. The other thing that goes with it, because there are so many companies between 1 and 100 employees, that it's, in my opinion, easier to sell 10 tens than one 100. Mm-hmm. And so that was the whole basis for paychecks.
And I think the
and
elephant
still is today.
I would think the elephant metaphor applies more broadly in society. For example, when a city, obviously such as Rochester, relies on one or two, or in our case, a big three major employers for years, and then those companies downsize or collapse, the city can be in trouble. I mean, it's sort of the same concept. If you're over relying on something massive, it can be great for a while, but you can be vulnerable. Fair enough.
Exactly. You know, that goes along with part of the book that talks about risk. If you remember reading about it, I talk about working for a company, a large company, could be much more risky than having your own business. For example, you as an employee of a large company could do very well. You could be a great employee, but your department does terrible. Or your department does great, but your division doesn't work out well. Or the whole company gets either sold or goes under, and your job is in jeopardy. There's no such thing today as cradle-to-grave security, in my opinion, with large companies. But if you own your own company, even though it may be a lot more modest, but if you own it, some of the advantages are, one, you can sell your company at some point if you want to. Or secondly, if you want to pass it on to an heir, like a son or a daughter or whatever, you have that capability too. And also, if you become physically or mentally impaired for some reason, you probably will be far better off owning a company like that than working for somebody, because you probably wouldn't be working for them anymore. So that's one of the little sales pitch I used to give to people when I was asking them to move out of Rochester to another city and start a paychecks office.
Talking to Tom Golisano about his new book, Built Not Born, and when it comes to sustainable growth for entrepreneurs, you talk about recurring revenue versus sort of one-time clients. And as an example, you know, you bought the Buffalo Sabres in 2003.
Yes.
And you come into the Sabres, and they had, if I'm remembering, you write something like 5,000 season ticket holders. And you, is that about right?
5,500, I believe.
5,500. And you were able to nearly triple that in a relatively short amount of time. The idea being that a business that doesn't have a whole lot of recurring revenue, it has a lot more uncertainty and a lot less stability. What was your thought process with the Sabres? I mean, was it a surprise for you to see that their season ticket number was that small?
Well, the team had done very poorly over a period of time. I think the management had raised ticket prices to a point where it was counterproductive, and that's where they were. When we came in, we thought we could do a lot better than that. And within a year or year and a half, we were up to 15,000 season ticket holders. Now, obviously, as you just mentioned, that's great for recurring revenue. And it put the team on a whole new basis for survival. And we did. Absolutely, we also had a waiting list of about 3,000 to 5,000 people for season tickets. We didn't want to fill up the arena with just season tickets, so we always sold some general admission tickets. And later, a lot of those people would become season ticket holders.
I think at the time, Buffalo was still stinging from the fact that Brett Hull was definitely in the crease when he scored the game-winning goal in the Stanley Cup Finals.
They still feel that way.
They do, and you can at least get on board with that, can't you?
Well, you know, we had a little ceremony last week at the arena. The Pegulas were kind enough to invite myself and Larry Quinn and Dan DePoffi in for a celebration of the 10 years that we were, it was actually 8 years that we ran the team. And Gary Bettman, the commissioner, was introduced right after us. We got a standing ovation, and they booed the heck out of Bettman because the commissioner at the time would not replay that game.
Buffalo never forgets, especially when it comes to sports. No question. Tom Golisano, our guest here. I'm going to get some listener feedback. Diane in Rochester sends the following. I do freelance teaching and consulting work. I've been told that I undercharge clients and that if I open an LLC, it would create the credibility to charge more. I'm wondering what kinds of fees are associated with that and what kinds of taxes I'd be paying. Also, do you think having an LLC does provide the credibility that would warrant charging more?
Quite frankly, I don't think I agree with that statement. I don't think it matters that much. A person that's going to hire you for consulting probably doesn't care whether you're a corporation or LLC or even a sole proprietor. Obviously, I think they're going to make their decision based on what they think your talents are. And I think they're going to make the decision that whatever you what you are charging them is either worth it or not worth it. So, no, I don't think it's a big help.
All right, Diane, thanks for that. And listeners, with Tom Golisano, if you want to email the program, it's connections@wxxi.org, connections@wxxi.org. What do people ask you the most, Tom? I mean, besides asking you probably for to invest in a company or to sort of put your money behind an idea, what's the most common question or concern you get from people who are trying to start off in the way you did in 1971?
Well, I must admit, the most common question I get today about the book is, why didn't you write it 20 years ago? Which, you know, makes me feel good that maybe I'm hitting a nerve someplace. But I think most of the questions, that we do get somewhere between 2 and 4 business plans a week directed at our office. Obviously, we don't get involved in most of them, but once in a while, one comes along that we like. I think the biggest issue always with entrepreneurs is, do we have enough financing? Where can I get financing? Will the bank help me, et cetera, et cetera? Usually around the issue around cash flow and capital are the biggest concerns.
Let me see here. Mark writes and says, I launched a company with my brother, and to say the least, it hasn't gone as smoothly as we had hoped. Any advice for getting out smoothly? Getting out smoothly. So you have a whole section, I think, on nepotism somewhere, if I remember correctly, don't you?
Well, yes, I do.
Or working with family.
Right. I wouldn't say it's a chapter, but there are some paragraphs. I've always been very concerned about nepotism. It can sometimes create such an uncomfortable experience for either the person that's higher up in the organization or lower in the organization and the people that work around them. So I would avoid nepotism if at all possible, if you can. But in a partnership with a brother or sister, that's a little bit of a different story. But I think good planning, if you had good planning, you might have tried to figure out how would you separate yourselves from each other if you both decided that's what you wanted to do. And that could be done contractually, or it could be just done verbally between two people that trust each other. But something you got to think about early on.
That's the prenup. Good luck, Mark. Thanks for that. Tom, there's at various points in the book, you write about acting professionally, building integrity, and, you know, sort of demonstrating leadership early on that, you know, sort of will build a reputation. And it's very clear from the book that, you know, you feel that you're building that reputation and that it will matter. It will matter to your employees. It will matter to possible clients. I'm wondering if you had to make, when you were making decisions on maybe whom to work with, if you ever decided against possible either partnerships, business relationships, because you think that someone or an organization did not demonstrate sort of integrity, professionalism that you hold for yourself.
That's a good point, Evan. Why would you ever want to get into business with somebody that you don't feel good about? It's hard enough if the partners involved or the people involved initially start off really liking each other and working well together. If you don't have that when you start,
I mean, I think you're really going to be in trouble later on. I think honesty and integrity are very key components of a successful relationship, and openness and fairness. I know they sound like, you know, high-level words, but I mean them very sincerely. I think when you demonstrate an honesty and integrity and fairness to your employee base, they're going to have a much higher regard for you and much higher regard for the company. And the higher the regard they have for the company, the higher the regard they're going to be for your customers of the company. So I think it's very important. As you know, Paychex spends a lot of money and effort in training employees. When you come into our corporate offices in Penfield and you walk in the front door, you are standing in the middle of our training center. We have 7 or 8 classrooms that are usually full every week of people from all over the country that come in to our corporate office for training. Why did we highlight them and put them right in the front entrance? We wanted to know we respect them, that they're important to the organization. We wanted visitors to see that and understand that we are very dedicated to providing a quality product, which, you know, obviously has to be the key to our success.
Let me get some phone calls. Andrew in Irondequoit, I'm with Tom Golisano. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey, Tom, how are you today?
Good. How you doing?
I'm well. I heard over the years that businesses don't care exactly what the tax rates are, but that they just don't like them to be changed, that they could build a business around the tax rate and around the regulations, but they just that what's disruptive is that when things get changed up that they get in trouble. Does that ring true?
I think that's a great observation. I know, myself included, that the one thing you want is consistency and stability in such areas as tax rates.
Right.
The last thing you want to do is be continually speculating on what the taxes are going to be, what the tax rates are going to be, how is it going to affect my business, how is it going to affect my cash flow. Give it to me. I'll work with it. Leave it alone after that.
Right, right. So if there was a huge disruption, like if Bernie Sanders got elected, that wouldn't be very good for business, would it?
My speculation is it wouldn't be the best choice, but that's just my personal speculation.
All right, let's back to the phones, and Dan in Hilton. Go ahead, Dan.
Hi, Mr. Golisano, thank you very much for your philanthropy. You've made our community much better, so we appreciate that.
Thank you.
I just want to address something Yeah, you're welcome. I want to address something I think you said early in the hour, and I don't want to misquote you, but I believe you said that the bottom 10% of Americans economically are better off than nearly anywhere else in the world. Did I get that correctly?
I speculated on it. I'm not sure it's true, but I would say we're at least in the top half or the top quarter.
Yeah, worldwide, I would say I would agree with you, but we're far from the top. And as an example, I would just give Norway. They've figured out that pure free market capitalism doesn't work well. Neither does pure economic socialism work well. So they've provided a mix, and a mix which is best described as democratic socialism. And they've turned it into the they have the highest per capita income in the world. Their bottom 10% is much better off than our bottom 10%. They're the most innovative country in the world in that they have more startups per person than the United States. So that's really turned into a big success. So you have to look at the balance between where capitalism works and where it doesn't work. And where it doesn't work, for example, in healthcare, you need a system that provides for people so that everybody has equal opportunity. So I just would like you to address that, please.
All right, Dan, thank you.
You certainly make an interesting point, and we know there are many facets of any country's government that are somewhat socialistic. I mean, right here in the United States, maybe you could say public utilities are, or the the concern for wind turbines and solar panels and all that, and
Medicare.
the way they're being subsidized. So yeah, there is a bit of socialism. The one thing I would ask, though, Norway has a population of about what, the state of Ohio, I think. You know, it's a very small country. I don't know if that makes a difference. And you may be exactly right. Maybe they are an example for us to look at, and maybe model something after.
Interesting. I suspect. Well, I admit that answer surprises me a little from you, Tom.
Why? Come on, Evan. You got to be flexible.
I don't disagree. Not necessarily endorsing the substance of any economic system, but just saying flexibility is good. Tom Galisano is our guest for another couple of minutes. Before we go, if you can you update listeners on what's going on with Greenlight?
Greenlight is doing really well. I mean, we still got a lot of gaps in the Rochester metro area that we want to fulfill, and we're doing them as fast as possible. We announced that we were going to Buffalo. We had a press conference there about, a month ago, and it was a really interesting experience because we did the press conference on a Tuesday morning, and by Saturday afternoon, we had over 10,000 people sign up. Now, it's going to be a long time before we're going to be able to deliver the product to those customers. But the enthusiasm is really high, and we're looking forward to getting going in Buffalo as well as Rochester.
And about our last minute here, some have called for the internet to become a public utility, and I'm curious to know, given what's going on with your work with Greenlight, what you think of that argument.
I just don't understand why you'd ever give government that much control over anything.
Internet included.
Internet included.
Well, I appreciate, as always, the time, Tom. The book is out now. It's called Built Not Born, A Self-Made Billionaire's No-Nonsense Guide for Entrepreneurs. Tom, in the book, riffs on his own life experience at times to sort of illustrate points, but this is not an autobiography. That is in the works, and that is separate. And I suspect we'll have a lot more to talk about with you when that is forthcoming, Tom, perhaps in the next year or so.
I look forward to it.
Tom Galisano joining us from Vox Now Studios in Naples, Florida, enduring an 80-degree day while we in Rochester sit here at about 20. Listeners, thanks for the feedback and the comments. Couldn't squeeze in everything, but did our best there. And as always, we appreciate Tom's time. We've got a lot more to come with Connections coming up here on your public radio here in Rochester and the Finger Lakes. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you're enjoying this Thursday afternoon. I just looked at producer Megan Mack. I almost said Friday. It's Thursday. It's a Thursday afternoon. We're right back with you next with another hour of Connections coming up.